Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Jethro Tull's 50th anniversary tour has three stops near us, July 5th, 6th, and 7th. JethroTull.com for more on that. I was able to speak with Ian Anderson fairly recently, and we spoke about the tour, his mocking of the concept album, and his embrace of it. We'll hear about his take on the concept of the Greatest Hits album, the Jethro Tull string quartets, and more. We're going to be looking at a variety of things. Of course, your 50th anniversary tour. For us in the U.S., this is the 50th anniversary, but I suppose you're really marking it 51 by now, right?
Well, that's right. And the weird thing is, I have to confess that I've already got dates in 2020, which are theoretically the 50th anniversary tour dates, but it's just there are places that we haven't done. Obviously in the USA, but clearly in many other parts of the world where we haven't done the 50th anniversary tour, with a production tour, with video and all that stuff. So it kind of rolls on for a bit yet, but, you know, we also do generic, just best of Jethro Tull concerts along the way, and at Christmas I do my cathedral and church fundraisers, which, you know, are completely different material,
right.
Different set lists and sources of musical madness.
Yep.
So it's a variety of different things that we do, but you're quite right. This technically would really be more correctly described as the 50th anniversary tour as far as the USA is concerned, because this time 50 years ago, I guess we were just preparing. I mean, we'd done our first US tour, preparing to embark upon the second one.
Okay. Regarding the 50th anniversary collection, since you mentioned kind of greatest hits tours, for lack of a better way of putting it, on the 50th anniversary collection, you selected the tunes on this one, if I read that right?
Well, yes, I did. Ultimately, yes. But what happened was that I made a list of about, I suppose, 70 or 80 songs and whittled it down to 50. And Warner's Music, the record company, they sat down and came up with their own wish list of 50 songs. And with some trepidation, I opened the email where they had it all listed out and timings and running order and said, would this work? And I thought, oh, we're going to be so far apart on this. But when it came down to it, we were actually only two songs adrift out of 50.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was quite, in a way, reassuring, I suppose, that more objective and commercially minded minds didn't vary hugely from my own sort of artistic and personal choice. And really the couple of songs that were different were maybe, in the case of their list, were maybe just replicated a little bit, or duplicated rather, in the sense of style or musical material or something made them... I wanted to make sure there was as much variety as possible. We went with my list, and then of course my running order, because as I pointed out to them, it's nice to do it the way they did it, but unfortunately they ended up with consecutive songs that would be in the same key or the same tempo, and those are things that are a bit of a no-no for the thinking producer, who has to try and make sure that you create variety and some musical drama in the way that you produce a sequence of songs for the listener to listen to, hopefully consecutively.
Yep. I, in all honesty, can't imagine a person behind a desk actually noticing that they're both in B-flat or whatever the case is. That had to have been...
Unfortunately, you also can't imagine half the musicians of the world or their producers thinking in those terms, because I've heard so many records where I thought, that's three songs in a row in E minor.
Yep, yep.
And, you know, and I think they're just not thinking this one through, you know.
With regard to the greatest hits type of thing, I won't be dwelling on this forever, but there have been several variations of Jethro Tull's greatest hits out there, and so many songs from Jethro Tull, to me anyway, belong before or originally next to another song on one album or another. they have a place in consecutive order when we're listening to these albums start to finish. And so I suppose that takes us away from the people these days that are only interested in tracks 3, 6, and 7. But I suppose the question revolves around selecting songs that are not next to
the Brothers and Sisters.
Yes, yes. And they ended up being broken up. You end up with a broken family, I suppose.
Yes, you do. Literally, yes. Siblings are torn apart and starting a new life in far-off lands. That is exactly how it's like. But, you know, I have to say in defense of the Best Of album that, you know, I'm not a great music listener, number one. So I think when I became a professional musician in sort of 67, I tapered off my listening to other people's work because I'm starting to write my own songs. And by the time Jethro Tull was, you know, quite successful around 71, 72, 73, I really wasn't listening to busting amount of music at all that you would call pop or rock music. I couldn't have told you what was in the Billboard top 10 charts or anything. I wouldn't have known if you'd asked me that in 1972, and I certainly wouldn't know now. I've just never really been close to, you know, the hub of contemporary music in that way, and increasingly I'm somewhat distanced from it. But I listen usually on an aeroplane, sometimes if I'm traveling in a motor vehicle, wearing very closed and tight-fitting earphones to try and reduce as much of the rumble and ambient noise around me. I listen more for relaxation and to calm the nerves, because I'm not a happy flyer. And I listen mostly to classical music, and it's virtually all, it's the Best Of Handel. It's the 50 best Bach pieces ever. It's the Beethoven string quartet compilation. It's that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's not that I'm lazy. It's just that I'm content to let somebody tell me what is the considered best way to get to know a classical artist, a classical composer that I'm not perhaps very familiar with. With Beethoven, I do have all of his symphonies on my iPhone, separate and complete works. And I have Handel's Messiah on my iPhone. I have the Bible on my iPhone. I have the Quran on my iPhone. You know, I have all these things that are with me all the time. But most of what I'm, if I look at my music collection on my personal listening device, then you will see that it is almost all Best Of stuff. You know, the Best Of Foreigner is there, the Best Of ZZ Top, the Best Of Meatloaf, as well as Bach and Handel and Mozart and all the other guys. I'm a staunch defender of the Best Of album being the entree for the less committed fan to find out and get the big picture in one considerable and usually very good value for money bite of a very large cherry. I think that's a good way to get into it.
I never thought about really like these introduction to Mozart or Handel or whomever. This would be very much like listening to a Jethro Tull greatest hits in that you're maybe only getting certain movements. You're not getting the whole symphony.
Well, so, that's quite right. And if you know, the thing that will mark one of those Best Of classical albums is there are just the nitty gritty, the 3 or 4 minutes of music. And that, to a classical purist, is sacrilege, you know, to rip things apart in that way. But hell, you know, I'd rather listen to 3 or 4 minutes of Handel's Saraband, written originally for harpsichord, and an orchestration which is 3 or 4 minutes long because it happened to be used as the movie soundtrack to the movie Barry Lyndon many years ago. And sometimes, you know, I'm just going to be pragmatic. It's the convenience aspect of it. I'd rather have that than find my way, perhaps never at all, if all I ever did was try to trawl through the entire output of a major classical composer. I might just listen to a couple of things and think, well, this is not for me, and then never listen again. So I'm thoroughly grateful for the experience of getting to know an artist or a composer's work by that convenient method. Which reminds me, I don't have a Best Of Frank Zappa album. Maybe he staunchly refused to do those things. But, you know, I've got a couple of his actual albums. But it would be so nice to hear 40 or 50 Zappa pieces that were illustrative of the long career that he had before he sadly died.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's a very useful way for particularly a younger generation to get to know people that, you know, are maybe two generations prior to them. It's a good way of getting into the main ingredients of what they're known for.
Nice. It would be tough with Zappa. I'm a Zappa fan in a big way and have easily 28 or 30 of the albums. But again, it's that same sort of thing. They have a place. They have got those brothers and sisters.
she was a middle distance runner. The translation wasn't clear. Could be a budding stately hero. International competition in a year. She was a good enough reason for a party. Well, you couldn't keep up on a hard track mile. While she ran a perfect circle, then she wore a perfect smile. In Budapest,
well, let's talk about some of your kids, as it were, these brothers and sisters. When you're writing songs, one of the things that I just really love about so much of your music, whether it's released under your name or under Jethro Tull's name, it's generally not a verse-verse-chorus kind of thing. I mean, we do find repeated choruses, okay, but it seems like it's more of an ongoing storytelling or a poetry. At least those are my favorites and the ones that I appreciate the most. And so I wonder if you generally start when writing music or when writing songs. Is it generally poetry and or storytelling first, and then the music comes after?
Well, it's not formulaic. There's no factory production line. I try not to do it the same way all the time. And for that reason, when I've written songs since the very beginning, I often picked up an instrument that I can't play. Huh? Because that's a surefire way of not repeating yourself, because you're unfamiliar with an instrument and you fumble with it and try to get something, and sometimes eureka, you get a simple but effective little musical motif that you never would have thought of if you were playing it on an instrument that you had much more technical proficiency with. And also sometimes it comes from a title, comes first, and then I sit down to explore what I can make of that little idea encapsulated in the song title, and lyrically and musically, hopefully it'll kind of come more or less together. And other times, you know, it won't be a title, but it might be a line of lyrics, a phrase, like the song Too Old to Rock and Roll, Too Young to Die, came out of the phrase, which came about in a completely unrelated way to how the song actually evolved as a complete lyric. Or the song Budapest from Crest of a Nave, you know, started off because I was playing a concert in Budapest, and I thought, I'll write a song to mark this moment. And the next morning I woke up early at 6 o'clock in the morning, overlooking the Danube from a rather seedy hotel, and had my guitar with me and just three chords came to mind as a sort of a leading into beat one of bar one, and just immediately I'd had the first verse of the song all down and recorded on a cassette recorder or whatever I had with me, you know, before I had to run to the airport to fly back to the UK. And, you know, there are all those little moments which I remember very clearly and very precisely as to how they came about, but often it's from its images. You know, like many of my peers, I didn't study at music school. I went to art college, and that's where I got a grounding. And also from childhood, I was always keen on photography. And so photographic and painterly images are what very often stick with me and then are the material from which I then build a song. My taste in visual imagery, be it photographic or painterly, it's not portraiture and it's not landscapes. It's people in a landscape. You know, I like to see people in the middle distance, and I like to see them in a context. You could almost portray that as characters on a West End stage play. You know, there are people in a context, a theatrical context, and it, maybe it tells a story, maybe it just, it's just a kind of non sequitur series of moments, like Waiting for Godot. Yeah. It doesn't sort of really take you anywhere in terms of story, and at the end of it, you're no wiser than you were in the opening act as to what the hell is going on here. But it's a portraiture, but in context. And that's what I guess I like doing that most, because my music is objective. It's not so much very often telling a story as such, but it's not completely static either. You know, I like to flesh out my characters, but I do like to be, you know, drawing upon the visual imagery as a source of starting something off, and then it very quickly takes on a musical context for me.
Nice.
Hot night in Budapest.
It's Ian Anderson and the music of Jethro Tull for the entirety of tonight's KBC Arts. Later in the program, the Jethro Tull String Quartets. Also his work with Blackmore's Night, Candace Knight, and Richie Blackmore from Deep Purple and Rainbow fame. Again, Jethro Tull will be in the area at three different locations in early July. More at jethrotull.com. You're listening to KBC Arts on 91.9 KBCR, also at kbcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words but a whisper, your deafness a shout. I may make you feel that I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink. So you ride yourselves over the fields, and you make all your animals deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick.
Back now to conversation with Ian Anderson and the music of Jethro Tull. Now, as we go into this segment, it's time to introduce you to Gerald Bostock. Jethro Tull's fifth studio album, Thick as a Brick, was set up to look like a newspaper. In the newspaper, there's a story about a boy who was disqualified in a poetry contest. This boy was Gerald Bostock. The entirety of Thick as a Brick is co-credited to Bostock, fictional character that he is, though some folks miss this. We would then hear of him from time to time with later Jethro Tull works. Can we flesh out Gerald Bostock, please? This is someone I think that a long time ago I might have accepted him as an actual person. And,
in some ways, it's certainly, you know, Thick as a Brick is not autobiographical, but it certainly draws upon elements of my own childhood as a preteen child, growing up with some perceived set of values and cultural standards that I suppose we were encouraged to believe in as children. You know, it's from school and from peer group pressure and from sports and from fictional writing. So when it came to write the album Thick as a Brick, I wanted to explore the idea of a young child who's rather precocious, you know, way beyond his years, and is writing poetry in a rather grand and inflated manner. But in a way, it's about the confusion of children growing up to face an adult world where a lot of conventions and standards that they're encouraged to believe in as children become torn apart when they reach teenage years, and you have to start to try to make sense of it all with rejecting certain things and embracing other things. And, you know, I wanted the album to be like that, but at the same time, above all, it was meant to be a bit of a spoof, a bit of a parody of the then very popular prog rock concept album. And I was just setting out to kind of, in a tongue-in-cheek way, to outdo Yes and other bands of that ilk who were, you know, quite very often great musicians, but were sometimes maybe coming across as being a little too clever for their own tight-fitting boots.
Nice. Again, just like Mr. Bostock. Is it Bostock?
Yeah, Bostock.
Okay, well, Bostock.
Bostock is a North England family name that's not unusual. I can't think where I got it from. Maybe there was some lad at school when I was in grammar school in the north of England. Maybe there was somebody called Bostock there, but somehow it stuck in my mind.
Nice.
I don't know where I got it from, but Gerald, to be called Gerald as opposed to Jerry.
Yep.
You know, Gerald Bostock, it sounds a little old-fashioned, a little stuffy. And
yeah,
to be a schoolboy, you know, short-sighted schoolboy with little national health specs on and, you know, ill-fitting sort of suit that your parents have dressed you up in to look smart. He's obviously a precocious, rather probably gifted as a professional schoolboy, but most likely mocked and tormented by his schoolmates because he probably isn't very good at playing rugby or cricket. And these are things that you, of course, see. You, part of being at school, there's always somebody like that. There's usually two or three of them in every class who just can't play sports and are very often great at maths or history or something, and they're not popular kids. You know, they're the ones that get fun poked at them, and indeed, you know, sometimes very cruelly. But, you know, it's part of growing up. I often wonder, you know, how people turned out that I was at school with, you know, what became of them, the more gifted ones, the academically gifted children who seem to naturally do well at academic subjects. You know, how did they turn out in real life? And that then echoed itself some 40 years later when I reluctantly decided to do Thick as a Brick 2.
Yes.
And that became my working theme was, you know, whatever happened to Gerald Bostock? What might have befallen him in later life, this fictitious character? I had to kind of draw upon some of my own experiences of how people turned out in different ways and decided to look at, you know, what might have befallen Gerald Bostock if he'd taken a number of different potential path somewhere along the way. It was actually, as a notion, it was inspired a little bit by George Bush's autobiography after he left office. He wrote a book called Decision Points, and it was really just all these little moments along the way where he was forced to make a decision to take this path in life or that path. You know, whether it was quitting booze before it ruined his entire life, or whether it was that moment of apparent indecision when he learned the first plane had crashed into the towers, and that moment, it was seconds long, but it seemed an eternity, and he had to, you could see him beginning to make this momentous decision as to how to immediately deal with it and then what to do after that. And, you know, so I find myself thinking this is rather a good thing to consider, that we all in our lives, you know, we all must be able to look back at different moments in our lives and say, well, if only I'd done that instead of what I actually did, would my life have then turned out completely different? Or maybe I would have just ended up back at the same place anyway at the end of my life. Maybe I was sort of preordained. Maybe we're all just going to end up where we end up, and it's some kind of kismet, some kind of preordained ending. And that was the notional and somewhat humorous inquiry that I was making with Thick as a Brick too. But there is some good continuity there, 40 years apart against all the odds.
Absolutely. It really gave us a look at this man as he grew into, I suppose, middle age or so. The full title, Thick as a Brick 2, Whatever Happened to Gerald Bostock. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Ian Anderson. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. Jethro Tull will be in Indio at Fantasy Springs Resort Casino July 5th, July 6th at Five Point Amphitheater in Irvine, and July 7th at San Diego Civic Center. More at jethrotull.com. Now, I just happen to have in front of me, this is the one that Anne Layton sent me, the Homo Erraticus. So there's, yet again, there's the return of Gerald. And this one, I would say, if you were poking fun at the early concept albums, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, the Yes kind of stuff at that point, this Homo Erraticus, it seems you've embraced the concept album by now, or at least with that.
Oh, well, from time to time, you know, I've gone back and done that again. It started with Thick as a Brick, it went on to Passion Play, then kind of missed a little bit out, and then we got things that were thematically joined at the hip, like the songs of Songs from the Wood, or perhaps Heavy Horses, the things that were slightly more folk rock elements embraced in those. And then, you know, but the concept album essentially was Too Old to Rock and Roll, Too Young to Die in 76. And then, well, in fact, as a solo album, I did a conceptual piece called Divinities, which was for EMI's classical music division, which ironically got to number one in the Billboard classical charts. And so, you know, from time to time I do those things that you would say were kind of conceptual albums, and it doesn't necessarily have to start out that way, but sometimes you just have an idea which you think you can't really explore just in a single song because there are so many facets and elements potentially there, and you, or I, to decide that maybe I will make that a conceptual piece, which indeed was the case with Homo Erraticus. It was written at a time when we were beginning to see a huge amount of migration from countries of mainly of Eastern Europe, but also North Africa, sweeping into Europe. People, whether they were genuine political refugees, economic refugees, or imposters, which of course many of them were, preying upon the goodwill, particularly of the Germans, to settle in Europe. And so all of these things were causing an enormous amount of political and very divisive social unrest in many countries of Europe, which, of course, Donald Trump is doing his best to breed that degree of division and unrest as well in regard to migration. I mean, it's not just as simple as immigration. It's about something that, there's the whole point of that album, is about migration. It's something, I wouldn't be here if my ancient ancestors hadn't left the area of the Tigris and the Euphrates and settled briefly some thousands of years later in the Balkans area of Eastern Europe before heading off through Central Europe and Northwestern Europe and then making it over to what became the UK. So, you know, so I can trace my ancestors back from DNA to a high probability of at least going back as far as the Balkan era. I mean, we're talking somewhere in the region of 800, 900 years ago.
Sure.
And so, you know, I am the product of migration. Everybody in Britain, you know, we were once a new country, a bit like the USA. It's just that with us it happened a long time ago. In fact, in the Paleolithic and then the Neolithic eras, the immigration or migration into the UK was something that made us the people that we are. We're all a bastard breed of complicated origins. And in my lifetime, particularly since the 50s, we saw a huge amount of migrants from the Caribbean areas, from India, from Pakistan. Following partition in 47, a lot of folks took advantage of their right to come to the UK. And so during my lifetime, we've seen a huge amount of immigration of people of different skin colors, backgrounds, religions. But that was then, and since I was born in 1947, the population of planet Earth has increased by slightly more than three times in one person's lifetime, triple the population. And of course, facing the like it or lump it, believe it or not, but the inevitability of climate change and increasing difficulty of food production, you know, we're looking at a scenario into the future where migration 50 years from now will be on a scale like it's never been imagined before. And in fact, of course, combined with climate change, chances are it'll be the Canadians will be building a Trump-like wall to keep you guys out.
I hope so. We've got to come.
So, you know, we will be seeing such difficult times. Well, I won't be, but my grandchildren will. This led me to the topic of trying to, I suppose, point out that migration isn't just about physical reality of people. It's about the migration of ideas, of creativity, of spirituality. These are all part of the process of migration. Ideas, notions, beliefs spread out across the world. And, you know, I think we're all richer for it. But, of course, there are those who are the paid-up members of the Flat Earth Society who don't want to acknowledge climate change or don't want to acknowledge that there are people elsewhere who have perhaps a great deal to bring to the table in terms of creativity, inventiveness, and, of course, of economic benefit, too. But we're in tough times right now. And dealing with big, lofty, difficult subjects like migration, it's not the sort of stuff that most writers of pop and rock music are going to venture into. Chances are you're going to get torn apart because people will either misunderstand what you're saying or why you're saying it or violently disagree with you. So there's a bit of you've got to be a little clever, I think, in the way that you try to utilize any of those notions in contemporary songwriting. You don't want to make the mistakes that old John Lennon made back when he said, "We're bigger than Jesus."
Yep.
You've got to
yep.
be careful what you say. Thank God there was no Twitter around when John Lennon was around.
Oh, my God, yes.
He probably would have put his foot in it more than once.
He was apologizing for that longer than he... Well, that's...
Well, he had to apologize the following week, if you remember
yes,
rightly.
Yes.
But yeah, these are the sort of things that happen. And there are certain topics, I think, that many writers of pop music would be well advised not to pursue.
Yes.
Because they don't have the skills, or perhaps their views are already entrenched in some way, which will make them very unpopular.
Absolutely. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also, at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Back now to Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. For their 50th anniversary tour, they'll be hitting three spots near us, July 5th, 6th, and 7th. More at jethrotull.com. I'd like to hear just a bit about Jethro Tull, the string quartets. How did you connect with the Carducci string quartet? Let's just start with that. How did that connection happen?
Well, I was looking for a string quartet to record the album, which I'd thought about probably in 2016, 2017. It sort of occurred to me that doing an album of string quartet variations of Jethro Tull music would be fun to do, and to do in conjunction with our keyboard player, John O'Hara, who's a classically trained musician and composer in his own right. And then what I wanted to do was to do it quickly, in a brief period of time that could be allocated to writing and then recording the piece of music. So I had to find a string quartet. I didn't want to do it piecemeal. I certainly didn't want to get four musicians who weren't, you know, musically joined at the hip and capable of very intuitive performance. So it had to be an established string quartet. And I worked with a couple of string quartets from Hungary and from the Czech Republic in the past on tour, you know, doing live shows. And I've done quite a lot of work with orchestras, but I needed to find somebody, and it would be a whole lot easier if I didn't have to fly them in from Budapest or Prague. And I just, through a mutual friend, somebody said, oh, my brother plays violin in a string quartet called the Carducci Quartet. They're quite successful. So I looked them up, saw that they were doing a recital in London a couple of days hence, and I jumped on a train, went there and saw them and met them and had a quick chat. They were young, interesting. I mean, they didn't know who the hell I was or anything about Jethro Tull, but, you know, we were, I suppose, mutually enthused to give it a go, and they had an available slot when I had an available slot, and they got all the scores rehearsed. We got together for a day of rehearsal, and then spent the day recording in the crypt of Worcester Cathedral, who were kind enough to give that to us as a venue to record in, partly because I was doing a fundraising concert for Worcester Cathedral a couple of months later in the year, so they had to be nice to me. And then I found a disused, tiny, ancient little church in the middle of the countryside that we recorded the other lot of material. And so in three consecutive days we recorded the album, and then I got back and added my bits of flute and vocals and a couple of things with some piano in, and we got it done. We got it done pretty quickly, really, under the circumstances, and it was subsequently released. And rather like the Divinities album, it did, at least in terms of getting noticed, it did quite well. It too got to number one in the Billboard Classical Album chart. It seems like about every 20 or 30 years I get a number one Billboard album. Doesn't really mean anything.
That's right up there with beating out Metallica, which I don't need to dwell on. I know your thoughts on that one. But I do think it's cool that the drummer, several years later, did announce that it was a good thing that Jethro Tull did not put out an album when they won their Grammy later on. But
well, that's right. Yeah. And I think Metallica, like many other bands who might be thought of as being very deadpan, serious kind of guys with no humor at all, yeah, because of the way they perform. You know, yeah, there's not a lot of smiling goes on at a Metallica
right,
concert.
Right.
But you have to imagine that back in the dressing room, there's a few laughs and jokes and jolly japes. And so, you know, there was at least an illustration there of a slightly sort of humorous reaction to the fact that they didn't win the Grammy when everybody expected they would, which was, you know, upset, of course, a lot of Metallica fans, as well as professionals in the music business and the media, who thought Jethro Tull had absolutely no right to be there. But we didn't win a Grammy for being the best hard rock, oblique stroke, metal artist of the year. We won a Grammy for being, you know, a bunch of nice guys who hadn't won a Grammy before. That's why we got it.
It's your turn.
Yeah,
oh,
gosh, you know, yeah. If they had a category, I was hoping they'd come up with a new category with best one-legged flute player category, in which case I'd probably win it every year.
Yeah, I'll see what I can do. I'll speak to the Academy on that one.
Yeah.
Briefly back to John O'Hara and the string quartets. He was the arranger, I read. And so how about you? You said that this had been sort of fermenting for quite some time. You know, we have the reworkings of things like A Bungle in the Jungle. That's a great example with that. That was calling out for cellos and violins from the first time I ever heard it. So what were some of the earliest ones that you sort of started maybe humming as a four-piece small chamber work, you know, in your head, and then before realizing it?
I made a list, simply, and a longer list, and of course it contained more than 12 tracks, but it was a list of possibles. I discussed that with John O'Hara because it seemed kind of obvious that with some things you would make them pretty straight ahead. You know what you're listening to in bar one. Other things we thought, we'll make them a little bit more oblique and add some new material. And John, not just from the point of view of being an arranger, but being a writer, a composer, he added quite a few elements that were of his invention that were not necessarily part of the original song. you know, and we just kind of worked it out to try and find a good balance where there were some things that would explore more deeply what those melodies and harmonies of the original might have laid down in the first place. We'd kind of go a little deeper and extrapolate a little bit on some of those ideas. Other things we just kept really very much in the way they'd been done. So the song, for instance, Christmas Song, was done very much as it had originally been done. Same thing with Wondering Aloud. It was just acoustic guitar and voice and a string quartet, and or in the Christmas Song, a mandolin and a string quartet and voice. And so no great surprises there. But other places, you know, we fooled around with it much more. So there are sometimes lengthy introductory passages where elements of the melody just begin to come into play, but suddenly you realize what it is you're hearing, and you may be a minute and a half into the track before you realize, oh, I know what that one is. But that's part of the fun of you know, being a writer and a musician, is you get to, it's not teasing people in an unfriendly way, but it's teasing them in a way that you can tease old friends. Nice. You can josh, but it's not meant in an unkindly way.
Nice. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Ian Anderson. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. Jethro Tull will be in Indio at Fantasy Springs Resort Casino July 5th, July 6th at Five Point Amphitheater in Irvine, and July 7th at San Diego Civic Theater. More at jethrotull.com. Getting away from your music for just a moment, but your connection to Blackmore's Night. I spoke with Candace Knight about this, but I'd just like to hear your take on it. Were you hanging out at some of the musical parties that Ritchie Blackmore and Candace throw, or how did that happen for you? You were in their earliest albums, or album.
Well, I knew about Ritchie Blackmore before I became a professional musician. He was one of the names that came up in the British music press before I took the plunge to be a musician myself. And Ritchie Blackmore, Jeff Beck, of course, Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page. They were session guys down in London, young musicians who had come from rock and roll, but, you know, were thought of as being whiz kid guitar players, and so they got a lot of sessions, you know, on other people's records. And so I knew the name Ritchie Blackmore. Indeed, there was a producer who wanted Jethro Tull, before it was Jethro Tull, I think, he wanted us to record a couple of songs that he'd found in America, not my songs, and he wanted us to record these pieces, hopefully to get a single. And so he came up with a couple of songs and had us play on them, and he didn't like our guitar player, and he was trying to get this other guy that he says, great guitar player called Ritchie Blackmore, he'd be great for this, but for whatever reason it didn't happen. So we nearly ended up playing with Ritchie back in 1967, but we didn't. And then, of course, I knew of Ritchie Blackmore then through Deep Purple, who played, I believe, at the same Sunbury Jazz and Blues Festival as Jethro Tull in 1968 in the summer. At that point, I didn't meet Ritchie, but kind of recognized him as one of the players. And then by the time Deep Purple were getting pretty well known and famous, Ritchie had let it be known that he was a bit of a Jethro Tull fan in the mid-70s. And so we ended up, I think we ran into them in Australia, not on the same bill, but playing in Sydney, you know, a night or two apart. And Ritchie then, after the initial phase of Deep Purple, formed a band called Rainbow. And they were the opening act for Jethro Tull for, you know, a couple of tours, and so kind of got to know Ritchie. He was obviously a somewhat distant and remote and sometimes not terribly friendly character, but he's always been a perfect gentleman with me. And then he met the curiously named Candace Knight.
Yes.
Everybody thought, yeah, you know, it's the blonde bimbo, the younger girl, that's his, he's been seduced by this flimsy creature who probably has no talent at all, probably less talented than Linda McCartney, God rest her soul. But of course, then Candace turned out to be determined, and she learned to sing and learned to play a few things, and she actually started to be pretty good. And so I met Candice somewhere along the way. She came to some show. I think Richie was there as well, but he was too frightened to come backstage. Hmm. But I met Candice a couple of times, and then they asked me to play on a track for one of their first albums. So, yes, it was nice to see her come from really no musical skill or background to actually being, if you like, the front man.
Yeah.
In the sense that I think more eyes are on her than Richie, who usually maintains this somewhat sort of distant... He's almost like a sideman in his own band, in the sense that he's not really a very big front kind of performer. You know, he really wants the band to be a band, and he wants his wife to be the focal point of it, which she does admirably. And then, of course, when Richie then decided, against all the odds, that there would be a brief rainbow excursion, that was a big moment for him to step up and actually have to be kind of much more to the fore. Although he did have a singer who's had the invidious job of stepping into the shoes of his many predecessors in Rainbow, but they did pretty well. I saw some YouTube concerts of what they did. So that's kind of how I got to know them. And from time to time... Richie doesn't do email and internet. He's a bit of a Luddite. So there's no point in trying to send an email wishing Richie a Merry Christmas. But, you know, usually from Candice, we occasionally exchange an email.
I guess one last thing, and that is just to hear about The Ballad of Jethro Tull. This is a book I suppose a lot of people have been waiting for, although you go through a lot of the books on your own website that are out there about Jethro Tull. But this is actually straight from the horse's mouth, for lack of a better way of saying it. Scheduled for publication in 2019. Is that still on its way, let's say?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It is in the final stages. We're just finishing the artwork, actually, at the moment. I have, you know, sort of proofread and edited everything, and it's written by Mark Blake, a fairly renowned British music journalist who's done a few other, recently did a book on Peter Grant, the manager of Led Zeppelin, and the year before he did a very good biography of the early years of The Who, but he'd been a features writer for some of the music press for many years. So he's interviewed lots of guys that I got him in touch with, obviously ex-band members, but a couple of other people connected to the band, and our former managers, Terry Ellis and Chris Wright. And of course, there's a lot of stuff from me, because I'm the common link throughout, you know, 37 members of Jethro Tull over the years. But I didn't edit anything that the other guys said. I didn't want to be seen to in any way change their words, or if they were being a bit malicious, or sometimes, you know, having different version of historical events. You know, we all remember things a bit differently, and there were some things I would take issue with and say, no, that didn't happen, or it didn't happen like that. Right. But I left all their stuff alone. I did make a few factual changes to things where, in such a huge series of interviews and transcriptions, a few things were misunderstood or got wrong. And we subsequently checked on a lot of other facts and found there were a few factual things that we needed to research and change, but it's been 5 or 6 months in the making, and it's kind of ready to roll. I think we're just at the stage of final proofs of artwork. I approved the initial artwork, and the artist has got to finalize the finished version for the cover. But when you say a lot of people are waiting for this, a few people are waiting for it. And to be realistic, it's been put out by a company who recently put out a big glossy book about Foreigner. But only Mick Jones participated in it, and sadly, they didn't have contributions from the other guys, and it was basically all Mick Jones's recollections and stories. But it's a kind of a glossy coffee table compilation, and comes in a signed limited edition, and then a cheap and cheerful version that is available. But essentially, it's something that is just only going to print X number of copies and do their sums correctly to make sure they all get sold. But it's a collector's thing, really, for the dedicated fans. But I know there'll be some people who say, well, we knew that already. Because, quite frankly, a lot of stuff has been written by Jethro Tull over the years, and this is really just encapsulating a lot of stuff. There is some healthy amount of material in there that I've never read before, coming from people like David Palmer, now D. Palmer, following his change of gender. He was hugely entertaining, came up with lots of stories and interesting things. John Evans came up with some good stuff, and there's lots of things in there that I think the fans will never have heard before. But, of course, when you're telling the story, the events, the albums, the certain key elements, you know, will be things that are out there in the world of Mr. Google.
That's right. I appreciate you filling in the gaps in between Mr. Google and Mr. Wikipedia entry.
And the other gaps that are filled in are actually photographic, because I trawled my collection of work, some of which was added to by our bass player, the late Glenn Cornick, who kept a lot of early photographs and things, and they found their way into my collection of, you know, sort of historical Tull material. So I had a lot of material we could put out there to illustrate and give a little bit of another dimension into the visual look of the band over the years. It's a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to seeing the finished thing, because, you know, you're dealing with all of this in the slightly abstracted world of word processing files, and so it's just on a page on your computer, but something rather exciting happens when it translates into words on an actual physical page of a book, and with photographs and all of the pizzazz that goes with it. And also with the collector's version, there's a couple of tracks that are being released, audio tracks, poem that I wrote called The Ballad of Jethro Tull, which just sort of covers some of the history in a slightly sort of medieval kind of lyrical style, which is just a bit of fun. But stuff that, you know, for the fans, they will think, wow, never heard that before. Hopefully they won't hear it again.
For the entirety of tonight's KVC Arts, it's been the music of Jethro Tull and conversation with founder and frontman Ian Anderson. Once again, for their 50th anniversary tour, Jethro Tull will be in Indio at Fantasy Springs Resort Casino July 5th, July 6th at Five Point Amphitheater in Irvine, and July 7th at San Diego Civic Theater. More at jethrotull.com. That we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Ian Anderson and to Ann Layton for setting the whole thing up. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Shireen Awad, Taylor Milliner, and KVCR Director of Operations Tony Papa. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.